kind of right on the edge of going back to school. We homeschool, right? So it's a little different, but it still kicks in, and everybody knows now we're back at it, and the rhythms, all those things. And Davis is in university second year, so he starts on Wednesday, and so we can kind of feel all that stuff starting to happen. So of course, with the university thing comes, you know, paying for university, and so we took care of all that last week with him, and that provided a pretty natural occasion for a conversation about saving money. Which was something we sort of started doing for all of our kids when they were wee in the interest of their education, right? So now for Davis as an undergrad, we can help him with that. And that's a lovely thing, and he appreciates it. And at this time of the year when we're kind of paying that annual bill and some of that saved and invested money kicks in, it's a pretty natural occasion to kind of talk about why you'd save or invest, why it makes sense to start now or even before. You know, the sooner you start, the more the magic of compound interest does its work over time, and all those kind of things you want to teach your kids. And Davis is a thoughtful guy. I mean, lots of you know him, and so you know he muses about all sorts of big ideas. And in the course of this conversation, a couple of things came up. And one was a really kind of, I think, a natural and a lovely expression of gratitude, which we appreciate, and it's nice to experience that. The other was him kind of going, you know, because we were talking about him investing. We were talking about saying, here's an illustration of why you would do this thing called investing and why you would start sooner rather than later. And he said, you know, that all makes a lot of sense. But you guys get that, like, I'm living in an age where we all kind of feel that it's kind of obvious that the system and the short chunk of history that all those numbers are predicated on, that really might not hold together. Yeah. You know, yeah, we do get that. And it was an interesting conversation, because here's a guy, you know, from a generation that lives with a different sense of, I'm not going to say the likelihood, because that's too prophetic, you know, but the possibility of a global financial shift, the way that my parents' generation and my generation had to live like never before, with the possibility of us as humans obliterating one another with a weapon. And so every once in a while, there's kind of these seismic things that make you go, oh, I just need to rethink a whole bunch of stuff to live well in and around this. So it was a neat conversation. It wasn't gloomy, which my abbreviated recasting of it might feel like it would have been. It was just a chance to go, about something big. But having touched on all of that and having it still kind of rattling around in my mind and in my heart, it's still true that relative to the rest of the world, in the first world, we have enormous wealth to work with. And Karen, I think, did a great job of illustrating that a couple of weeks ago. But I wonder, in that intersection between being the wealthiest, perhaps the wealthiest, representing and living in the wealthiest period of history, maybe in the history of humanity, in many ways, I wonder if in the middle of that we're also starting to have this little voice in the back of our head that's saying that there are some things that we need to learn that we don't know about the way we think about wealth. And some of those things the poor know better than the rich know. And we need to pay attention. When one of those little mental burrs just stays stuck, you know, that's a reason to attend. And the story that I want to work out of, the biblical story that I want to work out of tonight, one of Jesus' parables, this is one of those oddball parables that you just probably never heard anybody put up on the flannel graph board, you know, or whatever. In Sunday school, like this one, just doesn't usually make it through the grid because it's well, you'll see. Stories in Luke chapter 16, and it is a parable, so we should expect some twists and turns and some paradoxes, because what parables do is they set one thing over against another and say, in the light of this apparent paradox, there's something to learn here. That's often the way they work as a form. So this is basically the story. I'll just kind of give you the big narrative of it, and then we'll dig in a little bit. So we talked last week about how the whole economy of the world that Jesus lived in was built around the household, and this idea of paterfamilias, of the head of the male head of the household, and how that person would have been, because the economy of the day was the economy of the household. So all the larger economy was a collection of those smaller economies, and even when things got big business-wise, it just meant that the household economy got bigger. The hub of the economic system was the family, not the corporation. And so the head of the economic hub was the paterfamilias, was the big daddy of the family. He was the guy. And so that's the setting for this as well. This story is also centered on, in this case in particular, on the paterfamilias, the man of the household, this kingdom of the household. And this particular household in this parable is one where there's a lot of trading going on, and where that household has become a pretty serious mover shaker in that town. And we know that because when we get toward the end of the story and we start to get some actual numbers, we know that in the trading that is happening out of this household, there are some people who have charge accounts with the household. And some of those charge accounts in our economy would represent six-figure numbers. They represent 7 or 8 years of salary. So there's some, that, and that's their indebtedness, not their full amount of the business they're doing. So there's a lot of business going on in this household. It's a big deal. And this guy would have been, this guy would have been like a CEO figure in town. And in all likelihood, busy with the sorts of things that an important, powerful man is busy with, you know. He would have had to go to Jerusalem for power lunches and to hobnob with the political folks that had sway in the whole country, not just in the town. And he would have had to show up for the big deal meetings. People in this town would have known this guy's name the way people in Seattle know Bill Gates' name, or the way people in Winnipeg know the Richardson family name, or, you know, he would have been that kind of a figure in the culture. And because he's a big dog, he's not home a lot, but home is where the business is happening, so he needs somebody at home to run the show. And so he has a business manager, and that guy takes care of all that stuff. And the job of the business manager in this cultural setting would have been a really good gig, because it could have been a job that would have gone to somebody who wasn't born elite, that wasn't born into that layer of the culture. You could have worked your way up to this one. You could have become skilled enough at the languages you needed. You could have become a person who had enough business acumen, who knew enough about how to manage accounts and keep books. You could have learned enough about the product that you needed to know. You could have developed the requisite people skills. You could have become that manager, beginning from a not cultural elite base. And as far as we can tell in the story, that's how it is for this guy, the person who manages his household. He wasn't born at this level. He's worked his way up to here. And the reason I'm mentioning all of that is because He's got a really important job, but he also is somebody who needs to know his place. And there's a curious thing about this culture and this way of doing business that may or may not be true in our culture. I think we'd usually like to think that it isn't. But in the culture in which Jesus is speaking and from which this story comes, it was perfectly acceptable for that manager to be skimming, to be taking a little bit from the customers for himself to kind of pad out whatever his salary package was. And everybody would have known that that was happening, and it would have been sort of business as usual. And the paterfamilias, the boss, would have been okay with that as long as the business manager didn't get carried away and start skimming too much to such a degree that the customers kind of revolt. Because in the end, this guy's job is to keep the machine of the business that this family is humming and being profitable. And as long as he's doing that, yeah, you know, we kind of just, he keeps the books, he cooks the books. We kind of just turn a little bit of a blind eye to whatever's going on in this whole situation with the graft and the, you know, the little bit for me, make it go smoother for you, way of doing business. So although he's in a position of privilege, he's also in a position that could become precarious if you weren't careful. And the story that Jesus tells is about a manager that wasn't careful enough. And what happens, we don't really know. Maybe the boss just happened to be in town. Maybe he decided to have a closer look at the books and did an inventory and kind of got something like a bottom line number. Perhaps he just heard a rumor around town. But whatever happens, he calls his manager into the office and he accuses him, in the words of Luke, writing in chapter 16, verse 1, he accuses him of wasting his possessions, wasting the boss's possessions. So he calls him on the carpet. And he says he wants an audit. He wants to know what's really going on. And it seems from the shape of the story that he gives the manager a bit of time to get the books together. The manager knows that he is in deep sheep. Like, he knows. It's at least that bad, Addy. And so he says to himself, as Jesus tells the story, he says to himself, my master is taking away my job. I'm going to lose my job. And I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. This is an interesting moment in the story. How many of you guys have ever, like, lost a job that you weren't expecting to lose? I'm not going to ask you to tell the story, but anybody ever kind of looked down the canon of this? Okay. So if you ever have, or even if you've been close to someone who has, or even if you're planning to leave a job and not knowing where you're going to, and it's under your steam, you know the kind of things that go on in your head, right? Like, you're kind of like, what am I going to do? I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't do this. Maybe I could do that. I don't know. Not much going on in that part of the marketplace. Like, all the stuff that just happens in your head, right? Where you're kind of, what's next? So that's what's going on in this guy's head. He knows that he has come to this position from the ranks of the peasantry, that he's worked his way up. And he knows that if he gets tossed back into the ranks of the peasantry, he's going to get eaten alive. He knows he doesn't have what he needs to do all right there. So he knows that he is in a lot of trouble if he loses his job. So what he does, this is where the story gets interesting, what he does is he starts calling in all the clients, his boss's clients, that owe his boss money for private meetings. And he calls them in, hey man, good to see you.
Hi.
He calls them in for these private meetings, and he sits them down one by one, confidentially, and he says to them, how much do you owe my boss? So one guy tells him, I owe him, you know, this many barrels of olive oil, 800 barrels. He says, well, you know what? He says, take your invoice and just right here, right now, you just cut it in half. Just turn it into 400. That'll be good. All right. Calls in the next guy. What do you owe the boss? I owe him this many bushels of wheat. Cut that into two-thirds of that. Cut that down by 30%. Just do it right now. And he just has a string of these meetings with all the clients who owe his boss the most. And his logic is that he is securing his future. He figures that if he does kind of unilateral debt reduction, if he loses his job here, that the people for whom he has reduced the debt will welcome him into their homes. Okay? Crazy like a fox. So he just goes for it. And he makes the most of the time he has left to ingratiate himself with his master's biggest, most indebted clients. And given what we know from Luke's telling of the story, we can't tell if the manager planned this outcome or not. It seems like probably not. But it seems like what happened is that he somehow, in this process, because his boss got wind of it, that somehow in this process, his boss looked at what he chose to do and decided that this guy, even under the duress of losing his job and his career, still had his wits about him. And he kind of liked that. And so he calls him in and he commends him. Okay? He says, nice job. All right. That's why this story never gets told in Sunday school. Right there. Right? Because all you got to do to know why we can't tell a story in Sunday school is imagine the kids' table and Naomi or Sasha or Megan or Marianne, whoever's back there working with the kids, telling them this story and then saying, so the way of Jesus is self-protection. The way of Jesus is actually looking out for number one, and if you have to get into the moral gray zone a little bit to do it, the Bible says it's fine. Right? Let me tell you the story. It goes like this. Because that's sort of the shape of the narrative, right? And then they'd have to explain what it means to cook the books. And, like, just, I mean, where'd you go with that? You know, like, where do you stop? You know, it's a kid's coming home in a car going, guess what I learned today? Anyway. I don't know about you guys, but in any given day, I might not feel like a rich person. You know, it depends what came in the mail, right? But I know that from pretty much any global vantage point, we are the very wealthy. We're the rich people on the planet. And I tend to notice this the most, my relative wealth, when I'm spending time with people that are actually poor. That's when I tend to notice. I notice it by contrast, I think. And as many of you know, this just happened to me recently in a way that would kind of make me go, whoa. We spent 3.5 months from January to middle of April not living in our own home because we had a house fire, so we were living in our neighbor's home because they were spending the winter in Mexico. How does that sound like for a wealthy story? Anyways, so this is where we're living. And we have, twice a month, we have a group of kids that are new to Canada that come and spend a day with us as a family. And they call it a CCE day in their educational experience, Canadian cultural experience. And so they just go and spend a day with these Canadian families. So they come and hang with us and they become friends. It's awesome. So when we had those CCE days when we were living at our neighbors, they came to our neighbor's house because that was home. And in the wintertime, most of these kids are from, most of them are Eritrean, right? So they're from Africa. And so snow, ice, like all of that Canadian winter climate stuff is a little bit novel still. And so we always put a rink in the backyard. And one of the things we do when they come in the winter is we go and play boot hockey. And they just love it. So we always have an awesome time playing on the rink. Well, we had the rink in when the fire happened. But the rink was in our backyard, not our neighbor's backyard. So they would come over to our neighbor's house and we'd have lunch together and we'd kind of lend them enough clothes to keep them alive at 30 below or whatever. And then we'd all go over to the other house and play on the rink and come back for hot chocolate and so on and so forth, right? It's great. Had a great time. So in the spring of this year, in June, we had them over for their wind-up thing. So they came over for a day to just, same kind of thing, just to play, have a barbecue, whatever. But it was the last thing of their school year. Right, so it's a big deal. So we're out, we got a whole bunch of bikes because we do this camp thing. So they're all out on the bikes. They're all out riding around everywhere in the country and just having a great time in the yard. And all of a sudden, a bunch of the kids are gone. We just can't find them. It was a little disconcerting. So we kind of track them down. And when we actually go start looking further and further from the yard, we find them and they're coming down the road, right? They're riding their bikes back toward our place. And we're like, so where'd you guys go? And they said, oh, we just went to look at your other house. They'd gone to the neighbors, right, where they came in the winter. Because, I mean, if people are stupid rich enough to have one house like that, why wouldn't they have two? There was no logical gap in there at all. You want to come in and sit down? You're welcome. You're welcome to do that, too? Yeah. That was kind of just their logic, right? I mean, the rich pink-skinned guys that are this family, I guess they just have two houses. Maybe they prefer that one in the winter. I don't know. But there was no hiccup. And so all of a sudden, in a moment like that, I realize, holy smokes. And it's not like this is a group of kids that have had no encounter with first world wealth. But still. So this is who we are. This is who I am. It's hard for me to get my imagination around the realities of even relative poverty, never mind killing poverty. And sometimes the only way I can do it at all, or approach it at all, is to deliberately look to those who've paid attention to the cultures of poverty and let them begin to inform my imagination about what that's like to live with that. There's an anthropologist, a guy named James C. Scott, and he's written quite a bit about the way that poor people talk. He calls it onstage versus offstage. And he did most of his research in a peasant village in Malaysia. And one of the things that he noticed in that village is that the poor or the weak, culturally speaking weak, so those with less power and influence, that the poor and the weak had two different ways of talking. They had a way of talking that he called onstage and a way of talking that he called offstage. And what he meant by that was that there were sort of these everyday forms of resistance that were practiced by the peasantry, resistance to those that had wealth and power. And the way that it worked is that the poor and the weak were really good at acting like they recognized the authority of the ruling elite in public. They knew when to say yes, sir, and thank you, and to kind of mind their manners and to ingratiate themselves. But when they weren't in that situation where they needed to give the impression of compliance with the social order under which they suffered injustice, what they did when no one in authority was around was they mocked that same system. Yeah. And they did it with things like gossip and slander and just by being non-productive, just kind of dragging their feet, right? Not getting anything done. So that's what he was talking about with the onstage, offstage thing. And he writes it this way. He says, "It is my guess that just such kinds of resistance are often the most significant and the most effective over the long run. Everyday forms of resistance make no headlines, but just as millions of anthozoan polyps create willy-nilly a coral reef, so do the multiple acts of peasant insubordination and evasion create political and economic barrier reefs of their own." It's an interesting idea, eh? Sort of an army of ants idea. The thing that's curious to me, from my limited vantage point, is that it's really hard to see this kind of wisdom if we live outside of it. It's really hard to see through that lens. But if we take the time to look at the situations in which the poor live, we can catch a glimpse, I think, of what Jesus was trying to get at with this weird parable that we just looked at. You see, Jesus isn't commending the manager in the story as a model of business ethics. He's commending the manager in the story for being what Luke calls, in our English translations, shrewd. His explanation of the major plot twist in the story, when the boss tells the manager that he's done well and commends him for acting shrewdly, Jesus' way of explaining that is, quote, "The people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light." And part of what he's trying to say, I think, to his listeners and to us, is that in the competitive economy of that manager's world, he has used a certain kind of wisdom, the wisdom of the weak, to win with a poor hand. He is engaged in an offstage series of subversive acts that secure his relationship with the only people that can save his hide on stage. Does that make sense? When Jesus tells parables, he wants people to think. They're supposed to provoke, right? They're supposed to get us to actually think about something. And if this particular reading of this parable has some merit, then it raises the question, what does it look like to engage in offstage tactics that reveal or even undermine what is broken about the current way that our culture approaches economics and relationships? What would offstage behavior look like if we believed that the system under which we operate is busted? What would it look like to be shrewd the way those playing with a poor hand are shrewd if the system needs to be addressed, but we do not have the power to address it head on, if you will? We need a subversive tactic. What does that look like? I think that our culture collectively is maybe beginning to get the feeling that addressing this whole paradigm for the way we do economics globally is an urgent matter, sort of like climate change or warming is an urgent matter. And so we're starting to have these conversations in the rooms where power is held with some urgency. And I have people who are friends and acquaintances who are in some of these meetings. And one of them told me an interesting story. He said it was like a Western world, an international Western world level meeting of global leaders of NGOs, of organizations that actually... Hey guys, come on in. What are you looking for?
I wasn't sure if you were waiting for something.
It is, but I think it's happening in the gallery right next door, main gallery. Yeah, no trouble. So they're in this meeting, and they got all these kind of leaders of NGOs that are all on about helping the poor, brainstorming about what the best way is for them to cooperate in doing this, right? And his job, he has spent most of his career actually living in slums in different parts of the world, in some of these mega slums in huge cities. And so he's lived with the poor in those exact settings that this meeting was about. And so they're a little ways into the meeting, and he's kind of listening to the conversation, and finally feels like he just has to say something. So he says, what do you guys think would happen if we got some of the poor people in here to tell us how it is and tell us what they think should be done? I'm just kind of quiet for a little bit. And hang on, I'll get there. And then it's quiet for a little bit, and then somebody says, you know what, that's just going to slow us down. And so from a distance, it's easy to see the problem with that way of thinking, right? Up close, maybe a little more difficult. But part of what Jesus is trying to help us understand here, I think, is that there's a pathway when we take on something like the way we think about economics. There's a pathway into that that isn't necessarily the one that looks fast and efficient and powerful. Because it's not primarily the kind of strategic pathway that those that hold and broker power would choose. It's the kind of strategic pathway, the kind of tactical pathway that the poor choose. It's that onstage, offstage idea. It's a kind of tactical insurrection that lives and plays by a different set of rules than the prevailing set of rules. But when a million people do that, you get a coral reef. You get an actual economic barrier. You get something substantial in the cultural setting that makes a difference. That's sort of the idea. One of the things that the poor people that I know seem to know that rich people don't necessarily know is that money is good when it does good, and that private good isn't good enough to make the world a secure place to live. And so despite the way that those of us who live with relative wealth are getting this feeling that addressing our paradigm for economics is an urgent matter, when we hear Jesus give us a parable like this in which he seems to be saying that the only thing that's really worth doing with money is to secure relationships, there's something in our Western brain that goes, beep, 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 bad idea. Because that feels like monetizing something that we don't think should be monetized. In fact, we struggle with the monetization of relationship all the time. Ever paid a therapist? Right? There's an intersection for you. What do friends do when they're really great? They listen. Man, they listen deep and they ask you good questions and right all these things that a good counselor or a good therapist does. I don't know if you've ever felt confused about your relationship with a therapeutic caregiver, but I have. I sort of feel like this person is more like my friend than my friend. The fact that I'm paying them to behave this way, well, that creates some dissonance. Yep, for sure. Doesn't mean it's not helpful, but it can be confusing, right? And so to our Western brain, when Jesus says the only thing, in a parable like this, the only thing that's really worth doing with your money is to use it to build relationships with people, there's something in our brain that goes, that's a bad idea. This is starting to sound like prostitution. By any other name, right? Buying something intimate.
Can you show me more personal examples? Because I'm homeless right now, but I heard you with your doctor that I can understand it a little bit. So, because I am homeless right now,
Yes.
But it doesn't predict any Bible text anyway, this is what I'm just talking about. So, just listening to your talk, I'm listening.
Well, let me keep going a little bit and see if any of this... No, not at all. But what I was going to say is let me keep going a little bit and see if the story that I want to tell... That's all right. See if the story that I'd like to tell makes any of those connections that you're talking about.
I can relate to that. I like that. It's the truth, but it's up to yourself.
Well, that's true.
Part of kind of like addiction, but I'm glad I knew myself. I'm not that addicted to it, but still. Because like you're. Never mind, I'm sorry. I'm not making sense.
That's okay. I'm going to keep. I'm going to keep going.
Pardon me?
I'm going to keep going.
Yeah.
And then we'll talk more in a bit, okay? All right.
Yeah.
Awesome. No, no trouble, man.
Yeah.
One of the reasons we get hung up is because we're so committed to the idea that money is personal and private. Right? This is, if you wanted to make a short list of things that are taboo in our culture for conversation, right, you'd have money and sex and religion in various forms, depending on who you're with, on there for sure. Let me give you an example of the kind of shift that I'm talking about in a contemporary setting, where I think this kind of shrewdness shows up. Got a friend, a guy named John Holofka. He's a Brazilian guy, awesome creative guy, photographer, lighting designer for film. That's kind of what he does now, lighting engineer. And just this passionate Latin guy, right? I mean, everything he just does with the verve of that culture, and just makes him a lovely person to be with. And he's got that same kind of contagion about his faith, because he's a passionate follower of Jesus. And so about a decade and a half ago, young guy, young Christian, fairly recently come to North America from Brazil, he decides he just wants to do something where he puts his faith into action with the poorest of the poor in North America. So he moved down to Chicago to live with Jesus People USA. And so when he tells some of these stories, it's really interesting, because one of the things that Jesus People USA did in their earliest days is they just moved in with the poorest of the poor in that culture. Because they figured, if we're going to actually be part of doing any good here, we actually need relationship. We actually need to know people. We need to be friends. This needs to not be vertical. This needs to be integrated. And so when they started to spend time with the people who didn't have what most of us would think of as homes, one of the things that these people showed them, now it's kind of almost a trend, but this was a couple of decades ago already, one of the things they learned about right away was dumpster diving. And the folks who really knew the schedule of what was going on just would kind of take them around and show them how this worked. Here's where you can get that at this time. Here's where you can get this at this time. And this is how they were living, right? And all of a sudden, the Japuza folks were going, wait a minute. There's enough resources going into these dumpsters to feed all the people in all the homeless shelters and ministries that we sponsor and that we're a part of. It's going into the trash every day. So they went to all these businesses with the proposition that the businesses couldn't very well refuse without looking pretty stupid. They basically said, if you give us your trash, we'll feed the cities hungry. And now, 30 years later, that's still what they're doing. It's fascinating. But it's an idea that they wouldn't have come up with sitting in the relative comfort of their culture of origin, brainstorming about how to help the poor of Chicago. Right? And there's an interesting thing about that story to me in the context of the parable, and that's that the poor people knew something that the rich people didn't know, and it was only when there was real relationship between those parties, when there was friendship and when there was mutuality, that's when the wisdom of the poor, that's when the shrewdness of those living in the culture of poverty and vulnerability came to light. And if we want to know what it's like to be treated to the offstage, onstage dynamic, all we have to do, it's easy to say, right? Hard to do. What we have to do is actually grow into relationship with the people that we are thinking about as objects of our generosity, as opposed to humans. I know folks that have taken that way of thinking about economics and friendship, and they've done some pretty transformative things with it. I know people like Tom and Christine Sine from the west coast of the U.S., from Seattle predominantly. They've done things like helping people in their community retire their mortgages in a fraction of the time by having other people in the same community who hold wealth become their financiers and be paid back directly. And the people who are doing the lending are getting the same amount of return on their investment that they would otherwise, but the people who are indebted are saving so much money that it's changing their life. Things like building entire complexes of housing under that same principle, where instead of going out into the prevailing system, they're creating these subversive acts of kind of microfinance and changing entire families' lives because of it. And I've seen this at work in the whole immigrant community as well, where people that have share what they have so that the whole community has a better chance to thrive. Whenever resources flow between people in relationship and in community for the good of all, whenever that happens, that's one of those little polyp moments in the coral economic reef, you know. That's the way this kind of insurrection works. Why is this so hard for us, do you think? I'm going to make a suggestion, and if whatever circle I'm drawing around us in this idea, I'm deep in it. Could it be possible that we don't think more like this more often than we do because we're actually not very good at loving our neighbors, and we're not getting any better at it because we don't think we need them now, and we actually really hope that we never will. That really what we're on about is self-securing. And we're so vigorously on about that, and sometimes so heedlessly on about that, that this whole other set of ideas that Jesus is trying to get through in this parable, we're like Teflon to those. If there's any merit to that thought, and it's a hard one, if there's some merit to that thought, then I think if we follow that little stream down a ways, we're going to come to loneliness. We're going to come to the just enormous ache in the culture of the relatively wealthy in the Western world that is just about wondering, if it makes me happy, then why the hell am I so sad? You know, to put Sheryl Crow's song around it. The idea, the kind of applications that I was illustrating in the last few minutes for this idea, and they were very broad and sketchy, and I know that, they're also really messy. This is a super messy idea, and maybe that's one of the reasons why it's hard. Because what happens if I lend money to Mike and he leaves town and doesn't pay me back? Mike wouldn't do that, but he's an illustrative human in this particular instant. Look, right? Somebody that I know, and I go, this is a relationship of trust, and we have this agreement, and you just screwed me over. And I'm out money. Because that kind of thing happens, right? If it happens to a bank, we might look at them and go, I saw your quarterly report. I think you're going to be fine. You know? You can take some losses. It becomes a strategic, it becomes like this battleground triage language. But in relationship, that doesn't really work, does it? Because it's personal. So this is a messy, messy kind of kingdom that Jesus is talking about here. It's just a life-altering sort of engagement with one another. It doesn't come with any kind of guarantees. Then again, the idea that the way that we do business with our money now comes with guarantees, as Davis pointed out in the conversation that I had with him the day before yesterday, that's illusory. That's predicated on a very short, relatively fragile piece of Western history. And the reason I'm banging away at Western is because one of the things, for instance, that happened in the economic crash of 08 and 09 in the U.S., when you look at what the bigger kind of umbrella set of numbers about what happened to American banks because of the way they leveraged things, and then you look at the picture of what happened to USA Islamic banks in the same period, it's absolutely fascinating. The Islamic banks did not suffer that same kind of crash that non-Islamic banks, because that's what we're comparing here, did. And the reason is because Sharia law forbids the charging of interest. And these banks actually took their religious law so seriously that they did business that way. And as a result, they were just fine. So we bump into a parable like this one from Jesus, and I don't know, I can't help but kind of look at it and go, huh, guess the idea of actually living like this parable might provoke me to live, doing business like this parable might suggest we should do business. I don't know how seriously I'm taking that. Because if I was, I think I'd have to make some pretty big adjustments. It's interesting, eh? It's kind of challenging. In contrast to that perspective that says that the way to secure things is to look out for myself, Paul writes to Timothy in the first letter to Timothy, and he writes this. He says, command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, which, by the way, you already know if you hung around here any amount at all. I do not believe the Bible supports that as being the age where we all leave here. I don't think that's what Jesus was talking about at all. To be generous and willing to share, in this way they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life. John Jansen, who's a regular, and his family, regular part of our community. John works for Siloam Mission. And his particular job is basically going out to schools and other kind of institutions and businesses and talking with them about what Siloam does and about what it looks like to participate in that kind of living in the culture. And he says one of the things that just makes him a little crazy, because John's a very passionate, focused personality, kind of an all-or-nothing, by his own description, an all-or-nothing personality. And one of the things that makes him a little nuts is having to say, you know what, there are things here that need to be done, and you guys can do them. I can't. But maybe you could. I appreciate his honesty about that with me. We have really interesting conversations about what love looks like for somebody who has a bunch of kids and a mortgage. What it looks like to change the way you think about and act with money. When is it unloving for one person in a community, even a community the size of a family, to say, nope, we're changing the direction on all this stuff and I'm going to put it all at risk because I got this vision about a better world, and if we crash, you're all coming. You're all coming with me. Sorry. That's a complicated idea, hey? So, these are not uncomplicated ideas. These are not ideas to get binary about and go, well, this is obviously an all-or-nothing thing that Jesus is talking about. One of the reasons Jesus uses parables is because they create this enormous zone of gray in which we have to use our imagination and we have to figure it out and we have to, moment by moment, day by day, relationship by relationship, kind of go, how do I engage this a little more? What does that look like? Why he doesn't stand up and say, here's a new law. He stands up and says, here's a story to make you go, hmm. And then he leaves and says, over to you. And that's us. Right? Wow. As a pastor in a community with people that at varying degrees, you know, I know lives that are shared in different ways. I sit down and I read something like that and I study it and I think about saying what I just said and I just go, man, is that kind? So I have my own dissonance about these things. But when I come to a parable like that, I don't know another explanation. I don't know another way to kind of come at the dilemma we have, other than some of the things that I've suggested. So that's the size of my lens. There are others, of course. But if there's something there that provokes some thought and consideration and conversation, then that's good. Maybe like our friend who popped in tonight and didn't stay. We're not that addicted to our ideas about money. Anyway, enough said.